So we're talking about Rabbi Zalman Meltzer, who was considered the brilliant Talmud of Rabbi Chaim Brisker. Rabbi Chaim, as we said last time, said about him that whenever he speaks up, he stimulates and opens up the channels of my thinking, of my mind. And he was known as the Ilui Sheva Iluyim back in Volozhin, and then he was sent by the Altar from Slobodka to open up the yeshiva in Kletsk, and later on he became the Rav of that city, and so forth and so on. So that was what we said as a historical, autobiographical, so to speak, sketch. But what we spoke about in terms of his Derech HaLimud is that he starts with reading a Rambam and being medayek, carefully reading the text of the Rambam. And based on that, he develops many different sugyas and many different machlokos in the Rishonim, especially against the Ravid. So we spoke yesterday about the Rambam's introduction to Nizkei Mamon, where the Rambam says that if he has nefesh chaya birshuso, who goes out mazik, then he's chayev. Called nefesh chaya shei birshuso shel adam, shei zika bailim chayovim. And Rabbi Zalman builds castles, as we saw yesterday, on this phrase of kol nefesh chaya shehi bershuso shel adam. He doesn't say bibaluso shel adam. He doesn't own the animal, but it's bershuso, with kama v'kama nafkiminis, as far as shomrim, as far as listim, and even as far as someone who has a dovar gorim lemamon situation in which it's considered his, even though it belongs to a guy, but the guy's going to force him to pay if he doesn't return the object, the animal. Now we're up to another example, and again, very similar to the first one in terms of Rabbi Zalman Meltzer starting with a diuk and a language and an analysis, and how it spreads in so many different directions. So what you'll see here is on page 348 in Rav Zevin's Sefer, the machlokas between the Sma and the Taz. This is a very fundamental and far-reaching machlokas about the nature of Kinyan Kesef. In English, I guess you'd call it a down payment. Like, let's say, for example, you sell me a piece of real estate that's worth millions, and all I give you is a shava pruta. So the two ways of understanding how that operates. According to one opinion, that's called kesef piron, meaning even though it's a minuscule amount that I'm giving you, it's a shava pruta, and that's it. But it's the beginning of a payment, as we would call it, a down payment. And that means that I have to pay you the differential. I'm already kona the piece of real estate. It's mine, but I owe you the balance. The balance is now a chov. The other way of understanding kinyan kesef, in the case of karka, is that this money that I'm giving you as a down payment is not at all payment. It's not at all reflective of the value of the object. After all, how could something that's worth so much, can you consider it that I gave you something of value when I paid you such an infinitesimal fraction of its value? So it's not kesef shivui, it's not money that's being paid for the karka that I'm purchasing, but rather it's called kesef kinyan. Kesef kinyan means that it's just a formal kinyan act. The money is not in any way payment, but that's the way you clinch a kinyan. Like, we have many different kinyanim, like chazaka works in karka, or kinyan suder works in karka. These are formal acts which clinch kinyan. And even though they don't entail any sort of a compensation, meaning we're not saying in any sense that you are, you know, we're evaluating the real estate at, you know, which is worth millions at one penny or one pruta, but nevertheless, it's a kesef kinyan. And the Avni Meluim of the Ktzos HaChoshen in his super commentary on Evin HaEzer writes that this machlokes between the Sma and the Taz really depends upon kesef kiddushin. Kesef kiddushin is your paradigm of kinyan kesef. And the Torah says that when a man marries a woman, he gives her kesef. That's where we have the famous Gzer Shava of Kicha Kicha Mistei Ephron. And just like in Karkos, you can be Kona Karka with Kesef, so too, you can be Kona and Isha with Kesef. Says the Avni Meluim, to the same extent that the Sma is of the opinion that Kesef in Karkos is Kesef Shivui, it's the beginning of payment for the value, and even if it's minuscule, even if it's such a small fraction, but it's the beginning of payment. Your karka is worth X number of prutos, it could be millions and millions of prutos, but I'm giving you the first payment. That's called kesef shivui. And the Taz, on the other hand, calls it kesef kinyan. It's just a formal kinyan act. And there's no way that you can count it or classify it as shivui. The same thing applies to kinyan kesef in kedushin. Kedushin, like karka, kicha kicha mistei efron, means that the kesef is a kind of Dmei Shivui. And the indication that it might be Dmei Shivui is that the Gemara says that that the daughters of a famous rich, for them you'd have to Mekadish them not with a pruta, but you'd have to give them an Isar Haitalki, which is worth many, many hundreds times more than a pruta. So you see that it's Kesef Shivui. To some extent, you are paying the woman for what she's worth. The Taz, on the other hand, who holds that in Karkos, Kesef is only a Kesef Kinyan, in order to formalize the Kinyan and clinch it, so too in Kesef Kedushin. This is not Dmei Shivui. And in fact, from the Taz's point of view, he should be able to be Mekadesh even with Pachas Mishav Pruta. So what if Pachas Mishav Pruta has no Shavius to it, but it is Kesef? And the answer is that Kesef in Halacha is a Shav Pruta. Less than a Shav Pruta is not called Kesef. Comes along Rabbi Zalman Meltzer, and he wants to disagree with this fundamental equation of the Avni Meluim. The Avni Meluim assumes that the Sma and the Taz would argue in the same exact way with Shitasam in Kesef Kedushin as they do in Kesef Karka. Rabbi Zalman wants to say the following. No. Kesef Karka is Kesef Shivui, I mean that's the Shita of the Sma, but he would agree that in Kedushin it's Kesef Kinyan. And he says the following, that I have many rayos from the Masu Matan, from the Shaka Vitari, the Gemara, and from different sources and Rishonim and so forth, that Kesef Kedushin is clearly Kesef Kinyan and not Kesef Shivui. And he's Medayik from the Rambam. Because if you compare two Rambams, one in Hilchus Mechira to the other in Hilchus Ishus, one defining Kinyan Karka and the other defining Kinyan Ishus, you'll see a difference in the Rambam's language. The Rambam in Hilchus Mechira, at the very beginning when he describes and defines Kesef Karka, he writes, Kesad b'Kesef, how do you acquire ownership over Karka b'Kesef? Machar lo bayis, machar lo soda, v'nosan lo hadomim kana. The Rambam calls Kinyan Kesef in Karkos domim. The word domim, according to Rabbi Zalman Meltzer, comes from the word dmei. Dmei means its value. Dmei this, dmei that. The Rambam then writes ein karka nikneis bepochas mishav pruta. That's already an afterthought that the Rambam adds, a secondary clause, a sefer. The Rambam says that you need to be konu domim, and a kinyan domim is whatever you put down, but there's a separate condition that you have to give him for domim at least a shava pruta. Less than a shava pruta cannot qualify as domim. And that fits in and reflects the sheet of the Sma, that the Sma holds that in karka you're paying dmei shivui, which means it's a payment, and it's a piron for the value of the karka. It's domim. It's dmeya karka, albeit part of the dmeya karka. But by paying part of the domim, you are kona the entire piece of real estate. And then what's outstanding, you have to pay as a chov. Compare that, says Rav Zalman, to the language of the Rambam in Hilchos Ishus. Ketzad ha'isha miskadeshes. What is the kinyan of kedushin as far as Ishus is concerned? He writes bekesef hu mekadesh. The Eino Pachos mi Pruta. He doesn't call it domim. He's not saying that he's giving the woman domim. Instead of saying Venosa lo domim, he says he gives our kesef for kedushin. And the Rambam says that you need pruta, shava pruta, as a minimum of kesef. Here the Rambam seems to indicate that the kesef itself creates the kinyan. It's not the fact that I paid you up, even partially, that makes the kinyan, but rather it's kesef kinyan. It's a formal act of kinyan l'shem kiddushin. So again, just to emphasize, because the Rabbi Zalman is going to build on this, he says that in mechiras karka, the kesef in the Rambam is domin, which means piron. It's a partial payment, and that reflects the shita of the sma. In kiddushin, however, the kesef is kesef kinyan, and it's not kesef shel piron. Oh. So with this, in the next paragraph, which starts with the word v'im, he wants to explain another sugya in Shas. And this is the sugya of kinyan meshicha. So now we're talking about metaltel, and we're no longer talking about karka. What is the nature of kinyan meshicha? What's the essence of that kinyan? On the one hand, you could say that the Torah, or the Rabbanon, depending upon where the kinyan meshicha is, Doraisa, Rabbanon, define this maisa. The mice of taking the animal, or taking the ring, or whatever metalton it is, into your possession, that's called a kinyan. That's a formal mice kinyan. Or no. Perhaps, what clinches the kinyan is the hachnasa l'rshuso, which, according to Mrs. Zalman, is called horas bailus. Horah with an aleph, not with an ayin. Horas bailus means that you do something that demonstrates that you're the owner. It's not just a formal kinyan. But if you take it into your shus, and now you can use it because it's in your backyard, that's called horas bailus. You've done an act that demonstrates and proves that you're the owner. That's the nature of a kinyan meshicha. Meshicha means taking it into your rishus. We'll soon see the nafkamina. And Rabbi Zalman suggests that you don't have to say the kinyan meshicha is a formal act of kinyan, the way the Taz understands kinyan kesef in karkos, or the way Rabbi Zalman understands kesef in kedushin. No, it's much more than just a formal act of kinyan, which was set up as a way of transferring ownership and clinching bailus. No, it's a horas bailus. It's an act that proves and demonstrates that it's yours. You have taken it into your rishus, and now it's designated for your use. And therefore, if we assume the second definition of kinyan meshicha, then it parallels in karka what's called a kinyan chazaka. Now, we spoke before about a kinyan kesef. Kinyan kesef, the Taz insists in karkos, is a formal act of kinyan. Chazaka, on the other hand, says Rabbi Zalman, is horas bailus. When I make a chazaka, for example, I plant in the field, or I set up a fence around the field, lechazeku kni, nal gun of a parts, all the different examples of a kinyan chazaka, that's called horas bailus. However, there is a possibility of accepting the original definition that we had of kinyan meshicha and possibly applying it even to karkos. How so? The original definition of a kinyan meshicha was hachnosas hachefetz l'rshuso, which I understand you can do in the case of metaltolin. But where do we find anything similar in the case of karkos? You don't take the karka into your rishus. He says the following.
Isn't the chazaka really just a raya of what the actual kinyan was?
There may be cases where he was kona with kinyan kesef and the chazaka is a raya. That's the third parak of the sect of Basra. But kinyan chazaka in the later prokem in Bav Basra is not a hochacha that you made a kinyan, but it is the kinyan itself.
I didn't get that far.
Okay. So now Rabbi Zalman wants to analyze kinyan chotzer. And he says the following. In kinyan chotzer, hachefetz nichnas l'rshuso. In other words, kinyan chotzer might be similar to the case of kinyan meshicha even without introducing the concept of Hochachas Bailus, but just simply Hachnosas Hachefetz Rishusa. So Meshicha, it's considered that symbolically I took the object, the metalpulin, into my Rishus. And if the object falls into my Chatzer, or you place it into my Chatzer, that's also considered Hachnosa L'Rishusa. So Mrs. Zalman wants to analyze, what is the nature again of Kinyan Meshicha? Is it Achnosas Achefes Rishuso, or is it Horas Bailus? And soon we'll see the Nafkimina. Claims Rabbi Zalman, this is a machlokas between the Rambam and the Raifit. The Rambam holds that Meshicha is just a formal Maisa Kinyan, and the Raifit holds that no, it's Achnosa Rishuso, and it's something that indicates Bailus. That's one machlokas between the Rambam and the Raifit. Then, he quotes a different machlok between the Rambam and the Raifid about the nature of Kinyan Chatzer. And he says the following, that even if, according to the Rambam, Meshicha is a formal Kinyan, he says that Afshal Rambam Hachnosa L'Shusa Hu HaKinyan, Ela Etzem Hachnosa Hu HaMaisa Kinyan. So the Hachnosa L'Rishuso is the act of a Kinyan. In the case of Chatzer, the Baal HaChatzer doesn't do any act of Kinyan, but yet it's considered as if he was Machnas the Chefetz into his Rishus. Then we get to another dimension of Chatzer. He says the following. If we assume that according to the Rambam, Meshicha is a Maisa Kinyan, what is the nature of that Maisa Kinyan? The Rambam would admit that the nature of the Maisa Kinyan is Horas Bailus. The fact that I use the object in the case of Meshicha, or in Chazaka, the fact that I make a definite change in the structure, in the real estate, in the property, that's called Horas Bailus. The Raivid, when it comes to Chotzer, has a different approach. What's the nafkamina? What's the machlok between the Rambam and the Raifid? So this is a Rambam in Perik Dalid Mehilchus Mechira. What happens in a case where you have a very large object? Part of it entered into the Chatzer, and part of it was left out of the Chatzer. And this is going to be a machlok between the Rambam and the Raifid. Is Hotzi Mitzas HaChefetz Mishus HaRabin. So part of the Chefetz was removed Mishus HaRabin L'Shusa. In other words, just to fill in David, let's say I want to, no, just to get, okay. You know, because if you just one line, okay, and then you'll be able to hang in here, okay. Plug in here, I would say. If let's say I want to make a Kinyan on an object.
Yes.
So there's something called a Kinyan Chatzer. If it enters into my backyard that I possess, I can make a Kinyan on it. But here's a case where half the object was left outside my Chatzer, in Rishus HaRabin, and the other half went into my Chatzer. So this is a Machlok Shin, the Rambam and the Raifit. The Rambam says that in such a case, you're not Kone. Why? The Rambam holds that the Maisa Kinyan of Chatzer, like the case of Chazaka, is Hochachas Bailus. I prove that it's mine. And the question is, can I prove that something is mine if I only take part of it into my Rishus? So Mrs. Zalman wants to claim that Yesh Hochacha Af behichnis l'shuso miktas hachefetz. Again, you have to see all his proofs for this. But he says that if I took part of the chefetz into my rishus, that already is enough to prove that I'm the owner of the rishus, meaning the owner of the chefetz. If it wasn't mine, how could I get away with taking even part of it into my rishus? The Raivid, on the other hand, holds that you're not kona here, because the Raivid understands that chatzer is simply a formal kinyan. And a formal kinyan always has to be made on the entire object, the object in its entirety. V'lo moel shehichnis miktas hachefetz. It's not enough that he took half the chayfetz into his rishus because he has to make a kinyan on the entire chayfetz. You can't make a kinyan on part of the chayfetz. Again, there is such a thing as shudfus. You know, sometimes you can give me partial ownership on your object, and that's called partnership. But here we're not talking about partnership. And if we're not talking about partnership, then the kinyan has to be related to the entire object. So if you're talking about kinyan not as a formal act, but as a chachas bailus, that I'm proving that it's mine, well, if I took part of this long object into my rishus, that's enough to qualify as achnosas, as achnosas lushuso, as chachas bailus. But if on the other hand you need a formal kinyan, the kinyan has to be done on the entire object. And here Rabbi Zalman moves back to his discussion about nizikin, which we had yesterday. Okay, you weren't here, David, but yesterday we discussed damages. If my animal goes out and damages, then I have to pay you compensation if you're the victim of its damage. But the question was, let's say it's not my animal, but I'm in charge of supervising the animal. So that was that discussion yesterday. Today we're going to discuss a different part of nizikin, which is only, you know, you have to appreciate the unique nature of halacha. This you won't, well, there may be something a little bit parallel in other legal systems, but it's not the same. We have in our system, which is the last line on your page, going on to the flip side of your page, something called hezek re'ira, which means that if I invade your privacy by looking into where you are in a private place, that itself is called a mazik. So Mrs. Zalman wants to understand, what's the nature of this halacha? What do I require in order to prevent myself? Let's say your house is close to mine, right, we're neighbors. How do I guarantee that I will not be mazik you b'ri'ir by looking and invading your privacy? Tzorech bir, he says, eze chiyuv hu lasos mechitza. Do we say that since I own a neighboring property, I am obligated to put up a wall so that I won't look into your rishus? Says Rabbi Zalman, first of all, we have to clarify, why does Reuven have to put up the wall? The wall is an expensive wall. Why does he have to shell out for that? Both neighbors, the Tzad Hilcha Shechenim, are required to circumvent and avoid Hezek Re'iyah. So if that be the case, says Rabbi Zalman, they become Shutfim, they become partners, just like they're partners in this area. You know, you have up to here and I have from there. Let's say, for example, there's a famous case at the beginning of Bava Basra of a chatzer sheyesh bo kedei chalukah, which means that there's enough area, because the minimal amount of an area for chalukah to divide up into two people is got to be dalid al dalid amos. It's got to be four square amos. So let's say we have a piece of area of karka, and it's not dalit al dalit. I'm sorry, and it is dalit al dalit. So now we have a chalukah. Now, since it's large enough, we divide it into half, and it's considered now that we have a shutfus. We're both partners here. We divide up the chatzer, and now we are on two sides of the boundary of the chatzer. We're looking one into the other. So we have to set up a mechitza, and that mechitza is a mechitza shel shutfim, which means that if that mechitza ever falls down, each neighbor can obligate the other neighbor to rebuild it, and the stones themselves, which are worth money, imagine the big stones of the Kotel, right? Those stones are divided equally amongst the two shechenim. Does that ring a bell to you? That's the first Mishnah in Masechta Bava Basra. And the Mishnah goes on to say that even if the stones fell into the chatzer of one side, of Reuven, nevertheless Shimon still has a claim to half of those stones, because they built the wall b'shutfis as partners. So far, so good. He says the following. What if one of the two neighbors stands up, makes a claim in court? I don't want to chip in for this wall. I'll watch myself. I'll be very careful, and I won't look into your chatzah. I won't look invade your privacy. Yachal lomar, he can come and say lo azik lo ere. I will not see what's going on. I'll put blinders on my eyes, or I won't climb out the window to see. You know, whatever it is, and lo azik, and if I won't damage you. V'chiyim yodu Ruven and Shimon val Shimon yesh chashashu ganov. Yochol oso Ruvein laharchik es atzmo mimenu? Do we have some sort of halacha that we have to force Ruvein to give up on his suspicion of Shimon of Shimon's aganav? Do we have to force Ruvein to do so? You know, a person is allowed to have certain kinds of chashashot, you know, I don't know how you say that in English, you know, suspicions, I guess. And that's natural. So he says the following. What is Hezek Re'ir? What does it mean I've invaded your privacy? And therefore each one could be Machayev, the other one, each neighbor to build this wall. So now we're up to line number 4. You have it here on page 349. Ein Hezek Re'ir begeder mazik bepoal. We're not talking about the act of damaging befall in actuality, because again, each neighbor could say, "I'm not going to damage you. I won't do this re'ir." Ella, but rather, hezekel hu bazesha monea es chavero milishtamish b'chotze. I'm not going to come out in my undies, pardon the expression. You know, in a way that I should be covering myself and be very private, because I know that you could see me from next door. This already curtails my ability to use my chatzer. Kevin Sharoas Chaver Bechatzer, any yochal lasos dover shal tzina, anything that requires modesty and privacy, he won't be able to do. And therefore, he, insofar as the fact that he's close proximity and he has a window through which he can see his neighbor, he is already considered to be damaging his neighbor, even before he looks into his neighbor. He has to find some sort of system, some sort of modus vivendi to make sure and guarantee that he won't cause his friend to forfeit some sort of a use of his chatzah. What does it mean, the use of his chatzah? The use of his chatzah for dvarim shel tzina, for things that require modesty, and you don't want to do it publicly. The asks Rabbi Zalman she'eino ela groma. How can you force me to write a check to finance the building of this mechitza, of this kosel? What are you telling me? Because since I have the potential of doing a ma'aser re'ir, of looking into your chatzah, therefore I'm damaging you. Why am I damaging you? Because you won't be able to do dvarim shebitzina. That's only groma. That's only an indirect cause. I didn't do a maisa hezek. If I looked at you, so my re'ir could be considered a maisa hezek befall, an active kind of damage. But if I'm not looking at you, Ella, what, I'm here and you're embarrassed to, you know, you're inhibited to use your chatzah the way you'd like to do for dvarim shebitzina, I'm a gorim here. In the worst case scenario, call me a gorim, I'm causing you. And if that be the case, then Grob and Ezekiel is potter. So why do I have to pay, again, why do I have to finance the building of the chatzer simply because you're inhibited in terms of your use of the chatzer? Fine, but I'm a gorim, I'm not a mazik, I didn't do a maisa hezek. Says Rabbi Zalman, hallo, but nevertheless, even though Grob and Ezekiel is potter, Grob and Ezekiel also. Wow, this is an unbelievable breakthrough. And here I think we can see Rabbi Zalman as an outstanding disciple of his Rebbe, Reb Chaim Brisker. He's saying that there are two different dimensions to Hezek Re'ir. One is what we call a Din Mamon, and the other is called a Din Isur. One dimension is, well, in monetary terms, I'm causing you a loss of use. That's worth something on the market. But there I'm only a grum. But there's another dimension to Nezikin, and that's called Isur Mazik, that I'm not allowed to damage you as a religious requirement, as a mitzvah, as an Isur. And if I if I'm goring you that since I wasn't marchik, I didn't create this chotzer, this mechitza, I should say, therefore I was causing you some sort of a loss, then I violated an iser insofar as I caused you a loss.
In the case of the chotzer, aren't both parties involved equally able to see each other? Aren't they both equally sharing a responsibility to build the wall? Because both could be seeing each other.
Right. So Rabbi Salman says, why? If let's say you're one of the two, right? Yeah. So you come into Beis Din, and I say to you, David, I want you to foot the bill 50% of this machitza. So you say to the Beis Din, you know what? What's Berzal worried about? That I'm going to look inside and invade his privacy? I promise you I will not invade his privacy. I'll put a blindness on my eyes. I don't know what I'll do. Says Rabbi Zalman, the problem here in the Zikin is not the Maisa, the act of looking into my chotzer. If that be the case, you have a right to say I'm not going to look into your chotzer. But rather the act of Mazik is the very existence or the very potential of you to look into me. I'm going to be inhibited from using my chutzah the way I want to use it because I know you might be looking at me. And therefore, I'm going to suffer a loss. Comes along with Mrs. Zalman and says, that's very fine and dandy, but that's only called grubba b'nezikin. You have recourse to a court system in a case where you feel somebody is damaging you but actively through a maisa. But here, how is he damaging you? Simply by eating his breakfast in the morning in his dining room, which is across the street from your living room or your bedroom or whatever it is, that's only grama. Says Rabbi Zalman, grama b'nezikin is patur. That's true. You can't sue someone for damages in monetary terms for grama, but grama b'nezikin is asur. As far as the surim are concerned, the Torah prohibits you from even causing someone a damage. You know, I can do all sorts of things in my 4 cubits and set it up in such a way that I know it's going to damage you. So that when you come and claim I should pay you for damages and compensate you for the Zikin, I'm going to say, well, it was grama. You know, I did things here that, you know, something flew or whatever, you know. But the answer is, that's okay as far as the Mominus is concerned, in terms of a lawsuit. But there's another dimension here that there has to be injected into our equation, and that's Isur. And when it comes to the Isur Mazik is not just when I actively damage you, but even if I what? Inactively damage you. That's called Grum and Ezekiel Asur. Are we familiar with that principle? If you're not familiar, it's good to learn it because it has a lot to do with Dinei Shechina.
Is that Ben Adon Chaveru or Ben Adon Levakim?
Both. It's fundamentally Ben Adam L'Chaver, but it's also Ben Adam L'Mok. The Gemara derives from Sukkim, and the Gemara says that if you invade someone's privacy, even though you're doing it by grama, nevertheless, the Torah, Hashem, doesn't tolerate such a thing. Oh. Now Rabbi Zalman says, perhaps the pieces of the puzzle could fit into the place. He says the following. Ein menias ha'ishtamshis likai hezek ela in yeshlo lanizak schush ha'ishtamshis. When we say that since you could look into his living room or his dining room or his bedroom, that damages him because he's going to be inhibited in terms of Vam Shemitzino, that only makes sense if we premise our discussion with the fact that he has rights to use it. If let's say he didn't have rights, for whatever reason we'll see down the line, to use the possession, you know, the karka, the bias, or whatever, the way he wants to use it, if he doesn't have rights, then you can't claim that I'm causing you a loss. Dafka Oz, when he has those rights, he has monetary rights, which he purchased, and he paid for it, he has a contract to prove it, to use this, let's say, this house in the maximum way you would use the house, even for Dvarim Shevitzino, then Yochel Achriach Es Chavero, he can force his next door neighbor to be Monea, to prevent Hezek Ria, because if he doesn't build this Mechitza to prevent Hezek Ria, then he's impinging and limiting my use of the bias. Again, that's all because he bought the house and he has full rights to use the house to its max. He says the following. What's the case of Hishtamshus with the Schus Bailus? Hishtamshus and Schus Bailus is with a schus. Schus means, schus bailus means I purchased the rights to use it in that way. But then he says, there's such a thing as ishtamshus belizachus. Okay, and sometimes I use something even though I don't have legal rights to use it, but nobody stops me because no one has any ownership rights on it. I'm trying to think in contemporary life of an example of this. Can anybody help me with that? Let's say, for example, assuming you can get an engineer to back you up on this, you can actually dig below your, let's say you have a garden apartment, you could dig below the ground. Am I using the right word? How would you say?
Excavate,
and then you make a halal, you make an empty space, and use it for all sorts of things. You don't own that space legally. It doesn't belong to you. But no one else has access to that space. So in a sense, you have hishtamshus, but without a schus hishtamshus. In other words, befall, in actuality, you can use that area, but you don't have monetary rights. You can't sell it. No one could be considered a ganav if they steal it from you. And he says, in such a case, there's no such thing as hezekriya. I can't claim against you. We have to build a mechitza because you're looking into my subterranean basement, which I don't have any monetary rights to. I don't have a schus mamon in the area. And I think that this is quite common, is it not? But you know, that you dig below.
I know somebody who wanted to build on their roof in the area, but didn't get rid of from the neighbors. But imagine they did, and the people in the next building could look over. Do you have a time of hezekriya?
Right.
It wasn't the real right, it was just something that you
right, until now, if I go up on the roof, nobody owns the roof. But if I get rights to the roof, then they had this point out very well. It's a schus hishtamshus, and now I can claim to the neighbor across the way that he's impinging on my use of the roof. Again, he's going to say the same thing to me, and we'll split the cost on the roof. He says that there's a machlokes between the Rambam and the Ravid about Hezek Re'iv. The Rambam holds that it's midin mazik. Why? Because of the Re'iv itself. Lachen. What is the Rambam paskin? Achim shechilku. Ein lahem chalonos ze'al zev, chol echad yochol livnos ulahafil ala chalonos. What happens here? Let's say you have a window. Obviously, through this window, you want to get access to airspace, both for light purposes and for air purposes. Then I build in such a way that now it's so close in proximity to your window that now it's dark. There's not enough space for the sunlight to come in. That's called lahafil ala chalonos. And the Rambam holds that yachol hu af kodem shebono lochav eschaver listom chalonosov mishum hezek re'iya. In other words, let's say in the case of achim shechilku, that, again, I just want to get the case. Oh, it works like this. Before what's called chalukas hashutfin, before the two partners split the object, in this case the house, because they inherited the house jointly from their father, at that point, no one has the right to board up a window. And why is that? Because he says, after all, if you're boarding up a window, then no, I'm not sure why. I'm just got confused here. Just give me a minute. Again, so Rambam she ein lahem chalonos zel zev kol echad yochel livnos ulahapil hafil al hachalonos. Is the Rambam holds Yochelu af kodem shebona loch of eschaver listom chalonosov bishum hezek ria, which means that let's say I buy a property contiguous to your property.
The first one who builds a window is there's no hezeriah. The second one creates a hezeriah. Isn't that what you're talking about?
Right. So now I haven't yet built my house next to yours, but Yachal Lachav es Chavero, he can force his friend to block any windows that he wants to build over there. Let's say he has plans, so he wants to build a window right next door to his neighbor. So since his neighbor has already established his chazaka, his use, his rights to, let's call it the, you know, to the dining room, he can say to his neighbor who now purchased a piece of property next door that you have no right to build build in such a way that my chalon will be satum. Satum means it'll be boarded up, so to speak, you know, by the outside wall. So I have a right to af kodem shebara lochav chaver listom chalonosa mishum hezeker iyo. Ah, he gives another case. Not only where the guy is going to build next door and there'll be, you know, a flat wall that'll block the light, but even in the case where he wants to create a window, even at a distance, so the wall is not going to block the light, but that window will now create hezeker iyo. Now, why is this so? After all, hezeker iyo, we said until now, is a joint obligation, meaning each shachin, each neighbor has the albatross around his neck that he has to make sure that there's no hezeker iyo. Why is it in this case, if I already have my house up and there are chalonos there, I can prevent you from creating hezeker iyo by building a chalon? Why is it my right against you and you don't have a counter right against me? Meaning, if I have my chalonos, why, you know, you're building a house next door to mine, why don't you have a right to say I want to build my chalonos? So the Rambam says that once Reuven, we'll call him Reuven, has already established his use of the chalon, and he was not bothered by any peekers, you know, who are invading his privacy, he now gets a chazaka and his chus in the shtamshus. So the second guy, Shimon, when he builds his house, he's now creating a hezeker iyo. Now, in the case of Achim Shechilku, there already were windows in the house beforehand, and now we're splitting the house. Is then each person, each one of the two brothers, already has his rights to a chalon. Neither brother has a superior position or an original schus to prevent the other one from creating a chalon. Avla Ravid Sover. Okay, we have to see. Where's this Ravid? He says, I don't know. I'm looking for the footnote. I think it's in Hilchos Shechein Perek Beis Halacha Tes Zayin. Maybe we'll take a look at that inside. Can I trouble you, maybe, John? You usually help me out with this. Rambam Hilchos Shechein. I think it's Sefer Kinyan, if I'm not mistaken. It's either Kinyan or
Nezikin.
Or Nezikin. Yeah, it's in Nezikin. You're right, Nezikin. In Nezikin, John. Just make sure. Avol Ravid, he doesn't tell you what the Ravid says exactly. So v'shahezek hu mishum menias ishtamshus v'ein advar mamurim el k'sheyesh lo zchus al ha'ishtamshus. Open up Nezikin, I think you'll find Shechein in there. I haven't learned Babasa in about a decade. Is it in Nezikin or in Kinyan? That itself requires a whole... Ein advar mamurim el k'sheyesh lo zchus al ha'ishtamshus. Okay. Aval achim shechoku she'ein li echemem schus al sheni ein kan din cheskas hishtamshus. Thank you so much. Okay, so it's in Kenyan. Your trouble is when you change your mind. You know, like in exams, I think they did research on this. People change their mind, and they always research that. Well, not always, but I'm saying in many cases, the first answer was
correct.
Okay, so we're looking in Shechein and Perek Beis Halacha Tes Zayin. see what happens over here. Nope, this is not it. This is a discussion here about the size or the height of the mechitza in order to prevent hezek re'iyah. That's number 24 for the Ruchal Hezek. It's a little bit frustrating because I thought he quoted a Rambam, but now I don't see where the Rambam is. I will arrive at Sofer. Let's just try to do as best as we can, and then we'll go on to the next topic that I want to discuss with you. I will arrive at Sofer. Shahezek hu mishum menias ishtamshus v'yein advar mamurim el kshiyesh lo schus al ishtamshus. I will achim shechilku she'ein lechem yem schus al asheni ein kan din cheskes ishtamshus v'chein. Any yochalomer stone chalonuscha mishum hezek re'ir. In other words, if the claim against someone who's opening a window is hezek re'ir, it's based on my schus ishtamshus, that I have rights to use this living room or whatever it is the way I want to use it. Now you're opening up a window in such a way that you can invade my privacy. I have schus ishtamshus. And my schus ishtamshus gives me rights against any neighbor, any potential neighbor who wants to invade and limit my schus ishtamshus and curtail my schus ishtamshus. But says the Ravid, in the case of achim shechilku, there is no one schus over the other. They both have schus on the entire estate. So no one has the right to claim, you know what? Get your window out of here because I already have my schus ishtamshus. So I guess the Rambam and the Ravid are arguing about the nature of hezek re'ir. The Rambam is looking at the maisa hezek, and therefore, even in the case of achim shechilku, if one of the achim is looking through or potentially looking through his window, that's already hezek re'ir. But the Ravid says that hezek re'ir is fundamentally anchored not in the maisa re'ir as a maisa hezek, but rather in the schus ishtamshus that now you're impinging upon my rights to use it. The exception to the rule is going to be achim shechilku, because in achim shechilku, neither one of the heirs has a right for ishtamshus that's in any way superior to the other heir. They're both equal from the get. Okay, now I promised you yesterday that I wanted to tell you a few stories about Reb Chaim. So let me just see if I can find this. It's on page 60. We had the story, two stories about Reb Chaim, if you remember. One about the get, where he told Rav Yitzchak Chanan Spector, just send me a telegram. Is it kosher or is it possible? You remember that story? And the second story on that page was about a chol of Yom HaKippurim, where Reb Chaim told him to eat as much as he has to eat without hesitating, a full shear, and they jumped on Reb Chaim from the Shulchan Aruch. Why are you being so mekil on Yom Kippur? And Reb Chaim's answer was that I'm not being mekil on Yom Kippur, I'm being machmir on Pikuach Nefesh. And then he tried to push this into the Shulchan Aruch. The Reb Chaim said the Shulchan Aruch is talking about a case when he says Machino so pachos pachos shir, where he's not yet a chol sheyesh bo sakana, but he might become a chol sheyesh bo sakana. Pam achas. Here's an interesting story. Bol afan of Adam echad mi Brisk, one of the local members of the community in Brisk, and he says Bini, my son is being conscripted into the Russian army. Right now, he's in a hospital in a different city. But tomorrow, which is Shabbos, the physicians are going to make their rounds, and they're going to determine whether or not he's fit for the army. In other words, the man wants to know if he's allowed to violate the Shabbos to get himself over to the hospital, to make sure that the doctors will paskin, that he's not fit for the army. Reb Chaim lo chashav af l'rega. Reb Chaim doesn't hesitate for a fleeting moment. V'tziva olav sheyisa. He should travel. V'yasa kol ma shebiyodo lahatzil es b'no. to get his son out of the army, sheyesh kan mishum pikuach nefesh. Now, Rav Zevin doesn't tell you the details, but if I'm not mistaken, to get conscripted to the Russian army in those days, forget it. First of all, the anti-Semitism in the army was very bad, but more than that, it was almost impossible to lead a religious life and observe the laws of the Torah. So Rav Chaim looks to the right and to the left, and there were other spectators who thought that, you know, maybe he overstepped his bounds. So Rav Chaim wanted to explain his answer, and he said the following: If it's tarech b'no shalazela avod chameshanim b'tzava, ha'reza lo me'animna hu shebemeshach chameshashanim tifrotz milchama. He said that even according to your shita, you know, those who were questioning Rav Chaim and said, well, his life is not in danger. He says, but let's say the young man gets conscripted for 5 years. There's a chance that within the 5 years, there will be a war. War will break out. And possibly they'll send him, this young man, to the front lines. And it's very possible he'll get killed there. V'svek, svek, svek, v'shal pikuach nefesh do chashanis. So in other words, there's a whole stream or string of possibilities here that might lead to a life-threatening situation. Maybe they'll conscript him, maybe he'll be there for 5 years, maybe within the 5 years war will break out, maybe he'll be sent into the front lines, and maybe if he's sent into the front lines, he might get killed. There's such a stream it's almost like a domino of sveikis here, but Rav Chaim says that's called pikuach nefesh, and therefore we will violate the Shabbos. So you see again, Rav Chaim is very machmir on pikuach nefesh. The next story is about the first year of the World War One. Okay, so we're going back. When was World War One? 17?
1918, 19.
Okay, so 1917.
Fourteen.
Yeah, you got me confused. Right.
We were right.
No, because
my grandpa was.
Right. My wife had a great uncle who passed away, and he had trouble during 1917. So that's why I got confused. But 1914. Anyway, so what happened? Five Jews in Brisk, when the Russians came into Brisk, they took over these five Jews, they I don't know what word is, shaltu alem, they controlled them, and they decided to accuse them of some sort of a libel. The whole story was made up. Reb Chaim found out that, oh, I think I may have mentioned this story. Did I mention this? I'm getting confused here. That they could possibly bribe the shelton, you know, the authorities, if they offer them 5,000 rubles. So Reb Chaim, this all happened right before Yom Kippur, and Reb Chaim tried to raise the 5,000 rubles to save these five Jews, and he couldn't get together the money. So he went on Kol Nidre night to each shul and made a decree that we're not starting Kol Nidre until I collect a full 5,000 rubles. And at midnight, they finally got the money, and Reb Chaim ran around to each shul, told them they could start Kol Nidre at midnight. Now here's a very interesting story. Reb Chaim, in a sense, was midway between two extremes that were both sort of misnagdim. You know, they both like opposed to him. One was those who didn't accept Reb Chaim's, you know, analysis. You know, he was too revolutionary. The other extreme were those who went very far. They would have Hakiros that were up in the air. They were totally abstract. Does anybody know which yeshiva I have in mind? Maybe I shouldn't say publicly, but in those days it was Telz. you know, Tells was known to have these very abstract hakiras that didn't, you know, is the cup half empty or half full, and you know, what makes the tea sweet? Is it the stirring or is it the sugar? You know, these kind of hakiras which Rav Chaim couldn't tolerate. So in any event, there's one, he has a number of stories about how Rav Chaim dealt with his misnagdin, you know, on this side or on the other side. So there's a Rav who used to live in Yerushalayim. He subsequently passed away. He was the son-in-law of the Ritbaz from Slutsk. Anyway, so he tells Rav Zevin the following story, that he accompanied Rav Chaim on a trip to a big city. And when they got to the big city, Rav Chaim said to this Rav that we should go be, you know, as an honor to the Mor d'Asra, we should go first visit the Mor d'Asra. Now, when they got to the doorstep, Rav Chaim turns to his friend and he says to him, "Listen, I'm asking you a favor. Don't ask any questions of what you'll see inside." And he goes inside, and he, you know, the Rav and the Shtot says, "Shalom Aleichem." Rav Chaim knew it. He was one of the Misnagdim who thought that Rav Chaim's derech was too original, and so forth and so on. And Rav Chaim asked the Rav if he would be willing to discuss a sugya in learning. Okay? And choose a sugya if you can that, you know, that you have a chiddush in, something new. So as soon as the Rav started the first sentence, Rav Chaim cut him off, and he said, "For sure, kvodo, meaning your honor, is going to ask the following question from a different sugya." So the Rav said, "Yes." And then, as soon as he started answering the sugya, before he can get two words out of his mouth, Rav Chaim says, "For sure, this is what you're going to offer as an answer." And he said, "Yes." And then Rav Chaim said, "But of course you can ask from a different sugya." And he presented a different sugya that contradicts that conclusion. He said, "Yes." This went on for a full hour. And the Rav of the Shtut basically said nothing. And Rav Chaim built the whole shiur for him. When they walked out, Rav Chaim turned to his friend and he said, "Me'ata, from now on, shuv lo yomar, he won't say about me, sha'arav mi brisk, eni yodel ulmod." That the brisker Rav doesn't know how to learn. It's a very cute story. It always made an impact on me. Here he has a story about his misnagdim from the other extreme, you know, that they came up with very, very abstract hakiros. He calls them on the left side of the spectrum. He said that those hakiros are so thin, dakos minadakos, that it gets to the point of hispashtus agashvius. That's a phrase from the Mechaber in Hilchos Tefila. You know, when you climb up to a level that you're completely cut off from this world. He said that sometimes these hakiras get to the point where they're completely disconnected from this world. Rav Chaim won't nilcham b'hem. Rav Chaim would never argue with them. And lo hitriach atzmo b'vikuchim, he never entered into debates with them to try to convince them that their approach was wrong. He always felt that the emes, the truth, would be bokeh v'olam e'leh. The truth would always demand itself. But sometimes he wanted to be yotzei inside his chova, if you could call it that, with a little joke. You know, nothing more. He would take a little stab at it. So once it was a case where Reb Chaim gave an explanation to Tosfos, and there was a rabbi there who didn't like Reb Chaim's approach. So he said to Reb Chaim, "Ein lecha el dvarim kiksavam. You can only interpret what you see literally by translating." You know, Rav Chaim would analyze what he saw and then reinterpret the text based on a whole chakira. And this misnagid, he wasn't gerus Rav Chaim's derech of hezberim and chilukim. So he said, "Ein lecha el dvarim kiksava." So Rav Chaim, in order to answer him, he said the following. He said that the Gemara says that if you have Isuri Hanah, like for example Arla, and you burn them, then you're allowed to take the ashes and use it for whatever you want. And why is that? because once it was consumed and converted to ashes, ponim chadoshos bolakan. So he wanted to prove to the guy who this Zakein who was arguing with him, you can't take this literally, ponim chadoshos bolakan, because he says if you interpret this literally, then next time the Chas and Kala sit down for a meal as soon as the suin, and we need Sheva Brachas, all we have to do is take ashes and put it on the table and ponim chadoshos bolakan. That was the way Reb Chaya would try to argue. He said he was once walking with another Rosh Hashiva from a different school of thought, and the Rosh Hashiva wanted to say that marriage, that nisuin and halacha, is a new kinyan every second. Yeah, every second there's a new kinyan. So Reb Chaya said to him, "Im kein, you know, if you're right, kvodo, is kumtir a mazel tov." You know, every second it's like you're married. Reb Chaim was kind to try to give him a shtup and saying that, you know, you've crossed all the boundaries with a kind of abstract chakira. Now this Rabbi Elio Baruch Mimir, who I think was called a Minsker Ili, I'm not sure, but anyway, Niftar, he died during the war, the first war, in the city of Minsk. And the funeral was set for a certain hour. So Reb Chaim turned to one of his colleagues, one of the Rabbonim, and he says, in the meantime, until the moment of the Levaya, why don't we go and visit my father-in-law, the great genius Reb Rafal Shapiro. Reb Chaim was married to Reb Rafal Shapiro's daughter. That's how the Soloveitchiks are related to the Netziv and the entire Shapiro family. So on the way, Reb Chaim asked the Rabbanim, please don't tell Reb Raphael that Reb Elia Baruch died, because that's going to upset him too much. And Reb Raphael is an elderly person. When they walked out of Reb Raphael, Reb Chaim turned to the Rabbanim and he said, Reb Raphael already knows. We thought he didn't know, but he does know. He didn't want to tell us, because you don't talk about the death of something, it's called Motzi Diva, but he knew. So the Rabbanim turned to Reb Chaim, and they said, we didn't hear anything from Reb Rafael, not even a remez, that indicated that he knew. Reb Chaim didn't say a word. When they got to Levaya, Reb Rafael was already there. Notice Reb Chaim had some sort of intuition, and he knew that Reb Rafal already was aware of it. He says, Reb Zevin says, Mida zu, this Mida of Reb Chaim, lechavein das acherim, that he can almost always guess what you're thinking, tvua b'Reb Chaim, mimei yaldusa, from his childhood. He says, when Reb Chaim reached the bar mitzvah age, and they were sitting around at the Suda, and all the Tuvei Ha'ir, the Chachmei Ir Brisk, were sitting there. Ukvar Eschilu L'Saseif L'Sudas Mitzvah Kara Ov Hagon Rabbi Yosef Ber's Beno Habar Mitzvah L'Cheder Miyuchad. So Rabbi Yosef Ber, Reb Chaim's father, calls Reb Chaim, little Reb Chaim, he's 13, into a special room, and he gives him a Rambam. And he points to a particular halacha in the Rambam, and he says to him, Tagid. Tagid means say a chiddush in the Rambam. Aval tagid mashani rotzeh tagid. I want you to learn pshat the way I want you to learn pshat. Reb Chaim sweated out omel v'yageya v'izia aval kiveng l'das oviv v'omars joshus of our mitzvah shalom b'divrei Torah al masha oviv rotzeh shu yagid. And he says he heard this from Reb Chaim's grandson Reb Yosef Dov. That's my rebbe. He says, oh, we have to finish up. He says that very often the brisker Rav, meaning Rav Yosher Ber, the father of Rav Chaim, would turn to Rav Chaim with a question that came his way, even if Rav Chaim was very young, and he would try to elicit from Rav Chaim a response. So once Rabbi Yosef Dov, Reb Chaim's father, got a question by mail on what's called a Sofek Nekuvas HaVeshet, which means that after the Shechita they found a hole in the Veshet. The Veshet is the Safra, that's right. Not the windpipe, the Safra. Now there's a long, long discussion about this in the Achronim. And Rabbi Yosher Ber wanted to see if his son Rabbi Chaim, Lil Chaim, would figure out what the issue was and why the Achronim vacillated back and forth about this question. So Rabbi Chaim said the following. This is a young child. Behema b'chayeh b'cheskas Yisrael medes ad sheivadol chavamesh nishkota. In other words, until you know for sure that the animal was shechted, the chazak and the assumption is that it's awesome because it's Eimer Menachai, so you have to remove the Yisra Eimer Menachai through Shechita. But on the other hand, Rav Chaim said, Nishchita, once it's slaughtered, Becheskes Heteri Omedes. Now we assume, until we know otherwise, that the Shechita is a valid Shechita. Ashi Vadalacha, unless you know, Bamen Nitrefa, unless you know that somehow the Shechita was not a good Shechita. Therefore, Ketzad Ladon B'Sheilazu, how should we judge this case? From one perspective, Arei Nikev HaVeshet, if the Veshet has a hole in it, the Behema is an Avela. You can't do Shechita if it already has a hole on it. And therefore, we now have a Suffolk in the Shechita. And Behema B'Cheskas, B'Cheskas Yisrael Medes Hachi Yivad L'Ha Shechit. I'll be Edoch, Mitzad Sheni Arei Sof Sof, also, Maisa Shechita Kahogen. The Maisa Shechita was perfect. Eliyeh Sofik Mitzad Acher. And now we don't know. Maybe there's something that would have undermined the Shechita. But then we have a principle of Nishchita, once the Shechita was done. Becheskas Heter Omedes. So you have two Chazakas that contradict each other. You follow?
Isn't it similar to the famous case of the mikvah? Are you looking at the chazaka of the person going in, or the
chazaka of the mikvah? Right, the mikvah had a cheskas mole, but he has a cheskas tuma. So the two chazakas go against each other. He says, "Lo hispik Rav Yosef dov ligmar." Before he heard the, you know, Rav Chaim's analysis, vihine, he says the following: that Rav Chaim took the initiative, because again the Sheila was in a letter that was sitting on his father's table. V'kosam es hatshuva. And Rav Chaim himself, you get the impression he was a child, he wrote the tshuva. And Rav Chaim added a proof to his conclusion. There's something called beis hastarim. Okay, when you go into the mikvah, the whole body has to have a contact with the water, but there's something called beis hastarim. That's an inner part which doesn't get exposed to the water. And what happens over there? He says, okay, well, I'm sure, you know, if anybody has to leave, I feel very guilty, but go ahead. He goes over the chakir. He says, Hashoche, when he did the shechita, he says, in other words, although the shechita knife doesn't have to cut into the entire veshet, only at one point, it doesn't matter where he cuts the veshet, but kol haveshet kulo tzarch lios royal shechita. V'im yesh nekev eino royal shechita. V'rei u'ma'akev es
hashechita. Is the rise of one similar enough?
I think you need Rov Shnayim. I don't remember.
Rov Shnayim is halacha.
Oh, you mean as a hava mina? Maybe I don't remember. I'm not learning Shchid, but he says v'chein suffik b'dover tzarch lios royal shchid. In other words, the whole suffik was the veshet royal shchid. And now in zekmo suffik b'maisa shchid befall olo, shall we say that even though the suffik is not in the Maisa Shechita, because the Maisa Shechita was at a place in the Veshet where there was no Nekuda, Nekuva, Nekev, but we found the Nekev, and now we think that maybe the Veshet wasn't Royal Shechita. So what do you do in the case where you don't know if it's Royal Shechita, but on the other hand, you know that the Maisa Shechita was perfectly good? So he says the following, that if you take a look in Shulchan Aruch, in Simon Kuf Tzadi Tes, the name of the Ravid, is in the case of Beis Hastorim, Afal Pisha Sofik Im Hoyedavra Chotzeitz B'Shas HaTfila, You don't even know if there was a chatzitza that would have prevented his body from having contact with the water when he went into the Eina tefila ola. The tefila is not kosher. Why? Mikavon, because let's say a woman and neither went into the mikvah, he becheskas tuma. Acheteda boru shetavla kahogen. So again, if there's any suffix in the tefila, she remains as a tmeya. Aval ima suffix hazehaya bebesa starim, mikavon shebesa starim eno tsarech lebias mayim befoal. Let's say in her private part she had some sort of a cloth or something. Well, she thinks she might have had. And that would passle the
tefillah,
because you need the beis hastarim to be royal lebias mayim.
The water doesn't get there.
Oh, but the water doesn't get there. He says, "If a sofek haya bebeis hastarim, the Shulchan Aruch paskins, kevon she'ein beis hastarim tzorach lebias mayim, ella tzorach chak she'ya royal lebias mayim, ein ze poselos hatefillah. For who adin kosav hayeled, for who atam." In other words, the veshet has to be royal shchita. If there's a nekev somewhere, anywhere in the veshet, then there's no shchita. But on the other hand, the maisa shchita was perfect. Now you want to know if the veshet was royal shchita. Same thing here. In Shulchan Aruch, you need that there won't be any chatzitza. If there's a chatzitza, the veis hastarim, the tefillah is not ola. But you don't need the maisa tefila with the bias mayim to hit the beis hastarim. But you need that the beis hastarim be roy for bias mayim.
Very good. But what's the brisker svara behind it?
The brisker svara is to, you know, again, this is not Reb Chaim typical, but as a child, you see that Reb Chaim was able to abstract the question, strip it of all its minute details. And once it's an abstract issue about, on the one hand, a maisa that was kosher, that would remove the previous status, but on the other hand, the maisa is only kosher if the object on which the maisa is done has to be completely roy, and the completely roy extends beyond the maisa itself, says Reb Chaim, that's exactly the subject of beis hastarim. Again, this is not Reb Chaim, you won't find this anywhere in the Sefer. This is just a story about Reb Chaim, to show you how Reb Chaim was able, number one, to abstract the question, and then, you know, to make a tzushtel, a hakish, another case where the same question exists, and the Shulchan Aruch passes that the tefillah is ola. Why? Because in a maisa tefillah bias mayim, there's no din of beis hastarim in the maisa tefillah. So the maisa tefillah is a perfect maisa tefillah, but again, it's only conditional on that the beis hastarim was royal bias mayim, and that's exactly equivalent to the veshet. And that's how he ends the story. He says, here's what you said, Daniel. Klum yesh lerot bekach, in this yelen, this young genius, reishis giluyav shal Reb Chaim liyosid, domani shehein v'lav. Ein Reb Chaim liyosid, rogil mahashvos, sugyos, mi merchak lemerchak. That's not Reb Chaim's style. Ein darko bekach. Al hachadira pnimit shal ha'inyan, to analyze the kishkis, lahamid es hashela al garineha hayisodi, Vada Yeshmem Roshem V'Yipatchuto Sh'Reb Chaim V'Yimei Gadluto. Beautiful story.
And then my question is more why is something lahokel in the case of Beis HaStorim, because it's right, it's supposed to be where it's gola. But that's I haven't got time to discuss that.
Right. Okay, then, good. It's a beautiful story. I think I told you a story about the water drawers, remember? You know,
yeah.
With the stones. There was, yeah. Chaim was eight, I think, at that time.